Okay. So ordinance of covenanting, we're up to part 13. And we'll be covering the topic now. We're moving into covenanting confers obligation. This will be the first part. We're going to be dealing with that whole issue. Reminding you again, our fourth term of communion, public social covenanting, is an ordinance of God, obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament. So we're going to talk briefly about why covenanting confers obligation. And then, having considered that, we're going to talk about how we know personal and social covenanting confers obligation. And we're going to be spending our time tonight mainly on the question of personal covenanting. But with this proviso, there's very little that we can say about personal covenanting that won't have some bearing or some relation to the idea of social covenanting. On the other hand, when we get to social covenanting, we will be talking about things that are peculiar to a state of social covenanting, and it wouldn't necessarily apply to a state when we're talking about personal covenanting, right? But our concern is to look at covenanting from the point of view of conferring an obligation. And the reason for this is, if covenanting does not confer an obligation, we've talked about various aspects of what it entails and so on, but if there's not some extra thing going on here beyond just praying or praising God or any number of things we can think of with respect to religious or devotional life, if there's not some special obligation that arises from it, it seems like there might be a very difficult time justifying the continued practice of it. Why is it that the Bible has so much to say about it? Why does this idea of covenanting show up in so many places, so many stories in the Bible? And why is it the background of so many different narratives and different teachings? And a large part of that, the answer to that is this. Covenanting confers an obligation, a peculiar obligation. And we've used this analogy before, and I'll use it again. But it's something like this. The Word of God requires that we tell the truth at all times, that we're not going to bear false witness, right? That we're careful that we, in fact, are being truthful and that our words are representing something accurate, that they're an accurate portrayal of reality as we understand it and so on. But when we take an oath to tell the truth, now if we lie, that lie is not simply a lie, we call it perjury. Right? We understand that there is then an obligation which has been conferred. And there's something like this going on all the time in covenanting. So the question then, our first question is why? Why does covenanting confer obligation? We understand that it does. In fact, civil society, even in what we would call post-Christian modern America, has some concept of this. Right? You can't really function as a society without some sense of this, because there would be no continuity in any kind of contractual obligations. There'd be no continuity legal bindingness to say telling the truth in a given situation, right? in a civil / legal manner or in fashion. So people have an instinctive recognition of this, I think. And that really shouldn't seem too far outside of things we've already talked about and thought about, because as I pointed out very early on, covenanting is actually grounded and founded in light of nature. So let's look at this. Question one: why does covenanting confer obligation? Well, the answer is that what is promised to God by vow or oath ought to be performed also because of the act of covenanting. Right? Look at Deuteronomy 23:23.
Deuteronomy 23:23. That which has gone out of thy lips thou shalt keep and perform, even a freewill offering according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth.
Right, so one thing we can say right away is covenanting confers obligation because when we take an oath or make a vow, covenant, we're making a promise. We're not only now bound to do the right thing because it's the right thing, but we're bound to do it because we promised to do it. Now, this is something that we're going to have to consider. Why is that such a crucial point? Why is it such a crucial point that we, when we promise to do something, that we do it? The performance of that exercise is commanded. And the same law which enjoins that the duties thereby engaged be discharged finds the covenanter or the covenanting community bound by the deed itself to fulfill them. Look at Deuteronomy 29:9.
Deuteronomy 29:9. Keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do.
And thus, by the service that is of covenanting or oath-taking or vowing, the party under original obligation to obey is brought under one that is superadded. Look at Numbers 30:2.
Numbers 30:2. If a man vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth.
All right, so the premise of what we're saying is this. First of all, what is the subject or the matter of covenanting? That is, in fact, what is commanded by God. Okay, the subject matter. But what is that superadded obligation? Well, Moses describes it as a binding of the soul. Why? Why would it be a binding of the soul? What are you doing? Well, we have to remember that when God commands something, the command comes to you as the order of a superior to an inferior. But when you vow or take an oath or covenant in that capacity of inferior, you are now taking hold of that obligation voluntarily. You're owning the obligation. And so you are now not simply being driven by what we might call an external impetus to do your duty. You are acknowledging, and when you covenant or vow, you are taking upon yourself voluntarily and subjectively that obligation. You're making that external obligation one which is internalized and, in fact, commanding to you. So the covenanting party, not as independent but as under the authority of God, by means of the exercise binds itself to duty. Psalm 89, verse 34.
My covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that is gone out of my lips.
There's a binding of the soul from our side when men take hold of that obligation of duty, when they own it, when they, in fact, embrace it, and when they promise to do it. Now, it's not simply an external imposition. It is, in fact, an internal resolve. And that resolve is expressed by promising and promising, by its very nature, is an act of covenanting. When you promise to do this or that, you're covenanting. Whether or not you call it that or even know to call it that, there is a kind of covenanting or vowing going on. You know, you should always do the right thing. However, when you promise to do the right thing and then don't do it, there's a certain level of culpability that has to be imputed that wouldn't be there had you not done that. Now, that said, it doesn't mean that you're at liberty when you know you have the duty not to do that. Because part of, and we've seen this, part of your duty is to undertake to do your duty voluntarily and promise to do it. So, he commands to vow that man may be brought under additional obligation. When they obey, he recognizes him as voluntarily engaged and, according to his will, additionally called to fulfill. Look at Psalm 76:11.
Psalm 76, verse 11. Vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared.
So it's wrong then to imagine that the obligation comes solely from the will of those who vow. For example, look at Acts 23:12.
Acts 23:12, and one of his days, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul.
If the obligation of a vow or an oath simply came from the will of the one vowing, it would be impossible then for you to say that there would be such a thing as an unlawful oath or an unlawful vow, or a situation where you've entered into a covenant and it was in fact unlawfully construed. Its purposes were unlawful. Why? Because the very act of making the covenant or taking the oath or making the vow would be sufficient ground for creating an obligation, if that was the ground of the obligation. But that's not the ground of the obligation. We know that it's not the ground of the obligation. That's what we're saying here. Why? The ground of the obligation is God has commanded us to respond to his commands of duty by voluntarily undertaking to do what he's commanded us to do, and promise to do that as he in fact provides us with the spiritual life and power to obey. So the obligation is not solely from the will of those who vow, or, you know, when people vow together to kill Paul, there would be a legitimate obligation there. They would have to fulfill it. Were not the exercise of vowing commanded, which, by the way, when God commands us to vow, if we stop and think about this, that already implies that it has to be done according to the word and command of God. If God tells you to do something, it has to do with his worship and so on. The acceptable way of worshiping the true God is, in fact, revealed by himself to us. You know, God, we shouldn't expect, because we know vowing is part of religious worship. And yes, worship God, that's a commandment of natural religion. But natural religion doesn't tell us the acceptable way of worshiping God. Right? So that all tells us, if we understand then, that we need the word and the command of God for how and concerning what things we vow or take an oath or make a covenant. So we're not the exercise of vowing commanded, nor the law of God to hold those who engage it bound by their own act. These should not be under obligation. Look at Psalm 56:12.
Thy vows are upon me, O God. I will render praises unto thee.
Yeah. Look what the psalmist says there. Thy vows are upon me. Why? What's the point of that language? What does he want you to understand? He's telling you that his vowing is not an act which he's undertaken of his own initiative, according to his own imaginations, or designed to achieve his own ends. Right? The means and the ends and the parameters of a vow or a covenant that could be called thy covenant presuppose that the word and command of God are at the center of it, and that in the very act of vowing, you have the command and the promise of God warranting what you're doing. By vowing, then, they bind themselves, not as by themselves, but by the authority of God. Look at Deuteronomy 6:13.
Deuteronomy 6, verse 13. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him, and shalt swear by his name.
There's a command, and we could multiply, but we've looked at this already. In so many ways, directly, indirectly, concretely, abstractly, corporately, personally, church and state, all different kinds of considerations we see. There are commands everywhere in various ways that are laid upon the people of God to covenant or to vow. And that means when they do it, they're not doing it of their own authority, but they're doing it by the authority of God. Right? That's really what that means. If I do something in the worship of God, not commanded, well, as God says in Isaiah 1, you know, who hath commanded this service? You know, who's commanded you to do this? You would have to say, well, it was my idea, or it was his idea, or her idea. But when we talk about vowing and covenanting, it's the authority of God. It's God's idea. It has the warrant and the command of God by his word, by the example of all of the godly who've gone before us, and so on. So they bind themselves not as by themselves, but by the authority of God. Or by vowing, they submit to a requirement of his law, and yielding obedience to which they become bound. Not by themselves, but by his authority to perform the duties vowed. Psalm 119:106.
Psalm 119:106. I have sworn and I will perform it, that I will keep thy righteous judgments.
Yeah, I've sworn and I will perform, I will keep thy righteous judgments. So I want you to think about what we're saying here now. Right? When you vow, when you covenant, you become bound to yield in obedience, not by your own authority, but by God's authority. So that, to break it down a little bit more, when God commands you to do X, Y, or Z, you are bound by an external moral authority to do X, Y, or Z. When you covenant to do X, Y, or Z, you voluntarily assume that moral obligation. You own it. You bind your soul to it. However, the authority by which you do bind yourself to this is not your own authority. You didn't do it because you thought it would be good for God. You do it because God tells you this is what he would have you do. This is how he would have you respond to his command of duty. And it's within this covenant, when you voluntarily undertake in that space, that's where you can, in fact, hope and pray for the influences of the Spirit of grace and so on to help you perform all of that. The reason I say that is this. God's moral law comes to all of his creatures. The command to duty is universal. It's on everyone, everywhere. If we were going to engage in a deontologized message, we could frame it like Kant says, you know, it's a universal imperative, right? Except it's not deontologized. There is a moral authority standing behind it, declaring it to be right. There is, with that command to duty, no promise that you will have the grace to perform the duty. God doesn't give that grace to everyone to whom the law comes. He only gives it to those who are believers. And so covenanting is a proper response because it's believing not only that we ought to do right, because as Kant would say, whatever is right for all times and all places, and we can test it that way. There's some truth to that. But more importantly, when we vow or covenant, we're acknowledging that what we're doing is right because God told us to do it, including that covenant. And so in response, and you'll only respond in faith, it's in that context then that there's a promise of grace to perform the duty. The promise of grace to perform the duty is not found then in the simple command to obey. It's actually found in the voluntary assumption of that obligation. Right? And you have, and this is important, you have the authority of God for that. If God didn't tell you to assume the obligation voluntarily, it would be presumption on your part to do so. You should do it. I mean, if he just told you to do it, apart from any other consideration, you should then probably do it in a slavish fashion. But he's told you he doesn't want you to do it as a slave in a slavish fashion. He wants you to do it as sons and daughters of himself. All right, let's move on to question two, which is where we're going to spend our time tonight. How do we know that personal and social covenanting confers obligation? Well, generally speaking, as we move through this, that personal and social covenanting both entail obligation on the covenanting parties appears in several things. First of all, there are several scriptures which present these parties as bound. For example, look at Numbers 31:4.
Numbers 31:4, of every tribe 1,000 throughout all the tribes of Israel shall ye send to the war.
I'm sorry, Numbers 30, verse 4.
Numbers 30, verse 4, and her father hear her vow and her bond wherewith she hath bound her soul, and her father shall hold his peace at her. And then all her vows shall stand, and every bond wherewith she hath bound her soul shall stand.
Yeah, so this idea of binding going on. In reference to the truth that a wicked ruler is destitute of right to claim the allegiance of his subjects by oath, or in any other manner, it is asked if the unrighteous judge might bind or govern.
Job 34:17. Shall even he that hateth right govern? And wilt thou condemn him that is most just?
Yeah, shall even he that hateth right govern? Well, that Hebrew word is chavas. Chavash, excuse me. It's a sh sound, it's a shin. Chavash. It means to bind or to govern. So governing, the right to govern is the right to bind. And without getting into all of our covenanter points on this particular issue of magistracy, let me point out, however, here we have another verse which is very clearly, I think, indicating that there is no right to bind the soul that would arise from an unrighteous judge. He doesn't have a moral ground for ruling or reigning. All right? And this is important. Can an immoral judge rule or reign? Only by force. But notice what God is doing in his universe. He's not simply commanding us. That would be governing by force. He's also commanding us to yield to that and do the right thing because he's commanded us to do that. Right? Which we're not going to understand or do from a point of faith, or except from a point of faith, I should say. Right? We're not going to do that voluntarily. And yet, the rule of heaven is actually not the rule of a tyrant. God isn't a tyrant. God is coming to us and telling us, yeah, you have this obligation over here. You must do this. But to his people, he's saying, I want you to want to do this. Which is why Psalm 110 says, my people will be made willing in the day of my power. Right? I'm going to make you willing to do it. Why? He's not an unrighteous judge. He has the right to bind you, to govern you, to command you to yield. And yielding is when you render voluntary service. Doing something under duress is not voluntary. Reproaching his servants, Saul noted that they had bound themselves, conspired is the word that I think the King James uses here, making a league with David, 1 Samuel 22:8.
1 Samuel 22, verse 8, that all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day.
Yeah, so David is dealing with a rebellious son who's conspired. That is, he's kashar. He's bound or conspired. Right? He's done something that indicates, you know, making a league, you're entering into an oath. And we're not getting into the question of whether or not it was lawful or legal or anything else like that. The point is that here David is accusing them of doing this, taking what is essentially, we should understand, as an ungodly oath or vow and making an ungodly covenant. But the idea is that they've bound themselves, because that's what is going on. There's a binding. Psalmist notes the same binding or conspiracy which he calls the pride of man. Psalm 31:20.
Psalm 31, verse 20. Thou shalt hide them in the secret of thy presence from the pride of man. Thou shalt keep them secretly in a pavilion from the strife of tongues.
Yeah, the pride of man is really the rokes, the band, or the league. Here we see then something a little different from what we saw earlier, you know, in the passage in Job. But again, the idea is they bound themselves, right? The wicked have, and the wicked evil always tends to mimic good. There's a twisting and a perverting of it. No different here. Moreover, concerning an oath or a vow, the law clearly references this binding. In Numbers 30, verse 2, in the Hebrew it's actually verse 3, but in our English it's verse 2. Numbers 3, 2.
Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word, he shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth.
So again, the word asar is tie or bind. Again, what we see is the idea in the Bible is you are, in fact, bound. You are, in fact, tethered. Whatever you've done, you've created this link. And we could call it, in fact, a spiritual link. And I say that because the binding is both mental and spiritual. Right? What people are doing is they're engaging themselves to do something from a soulish consideration. When you do something willingly before God, willingly, not under duress. You know, under duress is when you do something, I'm doing this because I don't want to go to hell. Right? Fear of hell. It's under duress. You're under the gun. But when you do it because you know it's the right thing and you want to please God, again, something which only is really going to occur or arise in a heart tuned by God's grace. But when that happens, well, you're binding. You're binding your soul. It's not a physical tether that you fasten, but it is a spiritual tethering of yourself to God. In each of these cases, then, the idea of binding is connected to that of covenant engagement. Though the verb signifying to bind is different in each passage, all appear in the emphatic form. And it's notable the binding spoken of in each of these cases is connected with the voluntary actions of the parties brought under obligation. So, for example, Numbers 30, verses 9 and 10.
Numbers 30, verses 9 and 10. That every vow of a widow and of her that is divorced, wherewith they have bound their souls, shall stand against her. And if she vowed in her husband's house, or bound her soul by a bond with an oath.
Right, again, we have other scriptures which point out that in covenanting, men are joined, and the word is lava, to be joined or bound to one another in a relationship. You're joined to the Lord, both Jews and Gentiles, both individual and nationally. So let's look at Jeremiah 50, verse 5, Isaiah 56, 3, Zechariah 2, 11.
Jeremiah 50, verse 5. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces to the word, saying, come and let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten.
Isaiah 56:3. Neither let the son of the stranger that hath joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, the Lord hath utterly separated me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree.
Zechariah 2, verse 11. And many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto thee.
Yeah, so when we talk about joining, it's sort of, the language here is much like we would use, for example, in carpentry, where we talk about joining wood. Take two pieces of wood, and we do various things, biscuit them together, right? So that we have two pieces of wood that now are really, structurally, they become like one piece of wood. Right? So we do that through biscuit joining and other things. This is not carpentry in that sense, but it is the same idea. There's a joining. It's spiritual, to be sure. It is a joining that creates an organical oneness between the parties being joined. So think about it. Binding, joining. This is a language of the conference of obligation. But the obligations that are in fact present to one of the parties in such a situation actually become they become the obligations of both, because both now become the one. They imply not less than that covenants should be made should be adhered to. Look at Hebrews 10:23.
Hebrews 10, verse 23, let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised.
Okay, let us hold fast the profession of our faith, the covenant, right, that we've spoken. Why should it be adhered to? Quite simply because there's a joining in a covenant. The joining of men to the Lord. And that brings with it all of the obligations that are in or of the one party. It makes it common to both parties. Now they are considered organically one. In the covenant of grace, we're one with Christ. Right, in the covenant of redemption, he pledged to become one with humanity. So there's this oneness, this joining that's going on. Okay, the same is expressed in passages, in one of which some are said to take hold of. Chazak, to take hold over seas. Like to seize the Lord's strength, take hold of it. Isaiah 27:5.
Isaiah 27:5. Or let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me.
And the other of his covenant, Isaiah 56:4-6.
Isaiah 56:4-6. For thus saith the Lord unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbath, and choose the things that please me, and take hold of my covenant. Even unto them will I give in mine house and within my walls a place and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Also the sons of the stranger that join themselves to the Lord, to serve him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, every one that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it and taketh hold of my covenant.
So to take hold of, to seize something is to, in fact, own an obligation. Right? You're taking hold of it. Elsewhere, they're said to take hold of or cleave to their brethren in their covenanting. Nehemiah 10:29.
Nehemiah 10:29. They clave to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and into an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord, our Lord, and his judgments and his statutes.
And we are told that a covenant is designated as sure or certain, instead of Nehemiah and Israel is so represented, Nehemiah 9:38, in Hebrew, again, 10:1.
Nehemiah 9, verse 38, and because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it, and our princes, Levites, and priests seal unto it.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, in that passage, if you look carefully, what you'll see is the word sure or certain is there, but the word covenant is in italics. It's clearly the covenant that's in view, but the taking hold of, cleaving, or being certain or sure, that is what is, in fact, standing for the covenant. Why? Because that's what the covenant does. Right? It makes sure or certain. Like Christ is the surety of the New Testament. Right? He became our surety in a covenant of redemption. How? He took hold of us and he took hold of God. That's what a kinsman redeemer does. He lays his hand on both parties, takes hold of these two parties at odds in order to bring them together, to bring redemption, to reconcile two parties which are at odds. He does that by cleaving to both. That's what mediation is. So there's a covenant. The mediator is in covenant with God in a covenant of redemption. He's in covenant with us in a covenant of grace. And he's laid his hands upon us both. Right, finally, those who engage in the exercise are said to cleave. And here the word is dabach, join or cling to the Lord. Look at Deuteronomy 30, verse 20.
Deuteronomy 30, verse 20. That thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, that thou mayest cleave unto him, for he is thy life and the length of thy days. Thou mayest dwell in the land which the Lord sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them.
So again, cleaving. Cleave, you know, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This idea of cleaving is that idea of joining, that idea of seizing, taking hold of, that idea of binding oneself. And all this is involved in covenanting. And again, that means that there is a real relationship created, and that real relationship confers real obligation. Right, this is represented in several places by Moses as a design of the discharge of the duty. Deuteronomy 10, 20.
Deuteronomy 10, verse 20. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave, and swear by his name.
Yeah, so Moses tells us to do it as a discharging of duty. So again, this is, you have to think about this a little bit. Covenanting is a commanded duty. But it is a commanded duty which allows us to access duty in a way of a yielding of obedience. We yield obedience. We're not obeying because God is cracking the whip. We're obeying because we begin to see and have a general sense of things as God would perceive them for us, right? We see the wisdom, we see the power, the glory. We desire to keep the law. By the emblem of the girdle, which cleaves permanently to the loins, truth of the appointment of covenanting as a means of securing devotedness to the Lord is taught in Jeremiah 13:11.
Jeremiah 13:11. For as the girdle cleaveth to the loins of a man, so have I caused cleave unto me the whole house of Israel and the whole house of Judah, saith the Lord, that they might be unto me for a people, and for a name, and for a praise, and for a glory, but they would not hear.
Yeah, so the girdle which the prophet had been commanded to hide, in process of time, was marred and profitable for nothing. But it represented not the faithful in Israel, who clave to the Lord, but those who, having vowed and sworn to him deceitfully, fulfilled not their obligations. Look at Jeremiah 13:1-10.
Jeremiah 13:1-10. Thus saith the Lord unto me, go and get thee a linen girdle, and put it upon thy loins, and put it not in water. So I got a girdle according to the word of the Lord, and put it on my loins. And the word of the Lord came unto me the second time, saying, take the girdle that thou hast got, which is upon thy loins, and arise, go to Euphrates, and hide it there in a hole of the rock. So I went and hid it by Euphrates, as the Lord commanded me. And it came to pass, after many days, that the Lord said unto me, arise, go to Euphrates, and take the girdle from thence, which I commanded thee to hide there. Then I went to Euphrates, and digged, and took the girdle from the place where I had hid it, and behold, the girdle was marred. It was profitable for nothing. Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, thus saith the Lord, after this manner will I mar the pride of Judah, and the great pride of Jerusalem. This evil people which refuse to hear my words, which walk in the imagination of their heart, and walk after other gods to serve them and to worship them, shall even be as this girdle, which is good for nothing.
Right, so a girdle is something which cleaves to the loins. And what does it do? The girdle is straddling the body between two sides of the body, two legs. There are two principles that are being held together, if you will, by the girdle. Right? They're being held in a kind of unity by the girdle, which is why it's used as an emblem of a covenant. But if in fact you take a girdle and you bury it, it over time it becomes profitable for nothing, right? It's good for nothing. And that's talking about those who'd sworn deceitfully. They'd sworn, but they weren't going to fulfill the obligations. It's like a girdle that's been buried, right? But the point is, a girdle, the image of a girdle is telling us there's an obligation, there's a real bindingness in this covenant. There wasn't, God wouldn't use the image of a girdle, right? By the way, this is contrary to the resolve of David to cleave unto God, Psalm 63:8.
Psalm 63:8, my soul followeth hard after thee, thy right hand upholdeth me.
It was in the exercise of vowing to God and fulfilling his obligations that he did so. Psalm 63:11.
Psalm 63:11, but the king shall rejoice in God, everyone that sweareth by him shall glory, but the mouth of them that speak lies shall be stopped.
All right, so let's just review this briefly before we move on to the next point, but that is, if we consider the various words, the various examples or allusions given in the Bible that have to do with covenanting, all of them carry with them or imply within the words or the, you know, the images, this idea that there is, in fact, some kind of obligation that is being created between the two parties that are joined, right? If there's going to be transference of obligation from one party to another, and that could be reciprocal as well. But there's definitely a conferring of obligation that has to be perceived in this kind of language. Now, that, I think would be enough from which to infer that covenanting does confer obligation. But we have more. So let's look second. God enjoins obedience as the fulfillment of covenant duties, for he gives command to do the words of his covenant. Jeremiah 11:6.
Jeremiah 11:6. Then the Lord said unto me, proclaim all these words in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, saying, hear ye the words of this covenant and do them.
Hear thee the words of this covenant and do them. Well, how could that be a commandment if covenant didn't confer obligation? It would mean nothing, would it? I mean, what does it mean to do the covenant, the words of this covenant? Why use that kind of language? Because there's an obligation. Something you can do. By his authority, he calls on men to keep the words of his covenant. Deuteronomy 29:9 again.
Deuteronomy 29:9. Keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do.
Yet keep the words and do them. So again, does covenant confer obligation? It sure sounds like it. The obedience thus inculcated was not merely made known by the glorious lawgiver, but acknowledged as obligatory by men, with Joshua 1:7 and Psalm 25:10.
Joshua 1:7. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law, which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest.
Psalm 25:10. All the paths of the Lord are mercy and truth unto such as keep his covenant and his testimonies.
Yeah, so, we know, again, from this kind of language, that the obedience which Scripture is inculcating is not merely that obedience known by the glorious lawgiver. In other words, God doesn't simply want us to obey because he's told us to do it. God wants us to do it because we acknowledge it to be obligatory. That's what's happening in covenanting. In two channels, then, from one source, its claims proceeded. First, directly through the promulgation of the divine law to men. Psalm 103:7.
Psalm 103:7. He made known his ways unto Moses, his acts unto the children of Israel.
And next, through the acknowledgement by covenant engagement of that law is holy, just, and good. Romans 12:1-2.
Romans 12:1-2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God.
Yeah, so, again, one source, God. Two channels. What? Well, I would suggest to you we can think of it in terms of law and grace. Right? Or law and gospel. Or covenant of works and covenant of grace. Right? In one, covenant of works or law, God is, in fact, telling us to be obedient as our glorious lawgiver. But in terms of grace, in terms of the gospel, in terms of the covenant of grace, God is, in fact, enabling us by faith to a voluntary acknowledgement of this command as obligatory, and therefore there is a dual press for obedience. Again, one is external, and if you will, alien. It's alien. The other is internal and is, in fact, personal. When you have faith, you're going to yield that personal obedience. So what we're talking about here, the way we receive the law unto duty, a way of duty, if we understand and think about the propositions, it's reinforcing this distinction between law and gospel, or covenant of works and covenant of grace. Had obedience been claimed to the duties inculcated as if they had been merely requirements of the law, they'd not been spoken of as performed in fulfillment of covenant engagement. In Hebrews 8:9.
Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord.
Continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord. What is the point here? If God simply looked for the performance of duties as a requirement of law, as the lawgiver, we wouldn't be talking about this idea of certain requirements of the law being performed in fulfillment of our covenant engagement. But the fact that God expresses this interest that we do what we do, not simply we're not keeping the law as the law. We're keeping the law as an expression of love to the Redeemer. And that makes all the difference in the world. Again, we're not keeping, when you only do something because of the external pressure, that inevitably feels like tyranny, even if it isn't. But when you do something because you really want to do it, it never feels like tyranny. Jesus says, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Well, keeping his commandments, if you really love Christ, is it going to feel like tyranny? No, because your motivation is love to Christ. That's your motivation under a covenant of grace. Your motivation apart from that is fear of hell. I'm doing this because I don't want to go to hell. But that's never going to satisfy the demand that God has of mankind. Because he doesn't simply want mankind to obey him as a lawgiver. He wants him to obey him as one who voluntarily assumes the obligation of creaturehood under that lawgiver. His words of the covenant are done or kept when those are performed. They're incumbent on account of the making of the covenant. Psalm 25:14.
Psalm 25:14. The secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will show them his covenant.
Right. The secret of the Lord is to them that fear him, and to them he will show his covenant. But who has the fear of the Lord? Not those who fear hell. People who fear hell, they don't fear the Lord. They fear what the Lord can do. They don't fear, they don't really have a proper fear. Because their view actually arises from a primary consideration of what it means to themselves. Whereas man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. So in order for us to do this the right way, our chief concern cannot be whether or not we're going to heaven or hell, but whether or not God is glorified. And yet one of the greatest evidences of the fact of going to heaven is that you want to do it. Not because you feared going to hell, or even because you desired going to heaven, but because, in fact, you had a real fear of the Lord. And so the psalmist is saying, those that have that kind of fear, to them he's going to show the secret of the covenant. What's the secret of the covenant? The secret of the covenant is what Augustine said. When he said, O Lord, give what thou commands, and command what thou wilt. Give me the ability to do whatever you're commanding me to do, and I don't care what you command me to do. Most people are looking at it from the other point of view, right? They're looking at it in terms of the law, and they're focused on that. That's what the fallen natural man is focused on. That. But the secret of the covenant is that God can, in fact, and does, in fact, give his spirit to those who are his children so that they can obey that law. By submitting to the rite, that is the ritual, everyone that received circumcision became a debtor to do the whole law. Galatians 5, verse 3.
For I testify again to every man that is circumcised, that he is a debtor to do the whole law.
Yeah. And what is circumcision? A sign and seal of the covenant, right? So in like manner, then, by covenanting, each one who vows to God becomes bound by his command to keep or do the words of his law as the words of his covenant. Psalm 50, verse 16.
But unto the wicked God saith, what hast thou to do to declare my statutes, or that thou shouldest take my covenant in thy mouth?
Yeah, he's rebuking the wicked because they want to use the law as a way of covenanting with God. Whereas it's the covenant which makes the law accessible to man. Right. So, when we covenant, just like circumcision, and this is really something I would say you have to understand, in baptism, right, there is an act of covenanting. We haven't talked about this explicitly, I don't think, yet, but there's covenanting going on. What are you doing? Well, you're doing what God told you to do, right? It's a command. A duty. Just like covenanting. Circumcision, baptism, duty. And by doing this, you're binding yourself to keep all of the law. But not simply as law. As covenant. This is a problem with the Jews. They view it as simply a matter of keeping all of the law. Circumcision for them is the keeping of it, just keeping of the law externally. But baptism, one reason the sign changes from circumcision to baptism is God is emphasizing the internal change which must occur. When that change occurs, you're not simply going to keep the law as a legal binding and condemning force. You're going to look at the law in terms of covenant. You're going to approach the law, in other words, not as the bare word of the lawgiver, but you're going to approach it as one who is willing to yield that voluntary obedience because you recognize there's this inherent obligation upon you. And you recognize that because you want to serve God, because you love God now. You're not scared off by thoughts of hellfire and damnation and so on. So the law, then the words of the law become the words of his covenant. Finally, the Lord commands that his covenant and his law be kept as a charge, which is manifest in Psalm 132:12.
Psalm 132:12. If thy children will keep my covenant and my testimony that I shall teach them, their children shall also sit upon thy throne forevermore.
So by his charge, or his law and covenant as a trust, he explicitly gives his people commandment to keep. Deuteronomy 11:1.
Deuteronomy 11:1. Therefore thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and keep his charge, and his statutes, and his judgments, and his commandments, always.
Yeah, this sentiment is reiterated, by the way, in the New Testament. It's not simply, so this, again, and we've talked about this before, but and I don't want to spend a lot of time now, but the idea that there was a different covenant under Moses, and not the covenant of grace, is just, I think, put to rest here when you start comparing things like this. So we'll get Revelation 2:25-26.
Revelation 2:25-26. But that which ye have already hold fast till I come. And he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations.
Right, so what does he say? He's saying, look, my word, my law, when kept as a word not of law but a word of covenant, that's really the keeping of the charge. People who keep the law simply out of fear, they're not keeping the charge. Why? Because again, the end that they have in view of that law is themselves. It's condemning them, and all they can see is that. It's reflecting back on them, and it's not putting them in a good light. They're focused on themselves or other people. What they fail to see is that the keeping of the commandment is when we hold that commandment in faith as an expression of our love to God for what he's done for us in Christ. In such injunctions, the same thing under two aspects is commanded to be kept, because the statutes of God are at once the commands of his law and the dictates of his covenant, right? And we're going to look at Psalm 89, 30 to 35 here, but keep in mind, again, of course, the law is, it has an objective quality that that demands the obedience of all men. No doubt about that, right? But there is this, and that's the command of his law. But that voluntary, or that yielding of that recognition of these things as being obligatory, morally obligatory, that is a result of this covenant. And we enter into that way of thinking, way of behaving, way of being, not simply by keeping the law, but by covenanting. So Psalm 89, 30 to 35.
Psalm 89, verses 30 to 35. If his children forsake my law and walk not in my judgments, if they break my statutes and keep not my commandments, then will I visit their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take away, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. My covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that has gone out of my lips. Once have I sworn by my holiness that I will not lie unto David.
These are kept as his law when obeyed, because of his authority as righteous moral governor of all. Psalm 47, 7 and 8.
Psalm 47, verses 7 and 8. For God is the king of all the earth. Sing ye praises with understanding. God reigneth over the heathen. God sitteth upon the throne of his holiness.
But they're kept as requirements of his covenant when they're recognized as not merely issued according to his sovereign will, but as having received the acquiescence of the heart and being acceded to by solemn oath and vow. Psalm 103:18.
Psalm 103:18. To such as keep his covenant and to those that remember his commandments to do them.
Yeah, so God wants us to keep his law not simply because of his authority as righteous moral governor of all. True, he is. That would be a reason for obeying, by the way. But God doesn't want his people to keep the law simply because of that. As some of the early secession fathers would comment, and one of the earliest questions Pastor Steele and company pick up in when the Reformed Presbytery is erected in 1840, this question of, is fear of hell a gospel motive to believe? And the answer is no. Right? We don't want people to disobey God, but we do want people to understand you cannot obey God in an acceptable way apart from this acquiescence of the heart that recognizes not simply God's right, his moral right to govern, but in fact loves him in the exercise of that moral right of governing. And you can't, the key is this, you can't possibly love God aright in a moral way of governing outside of Christ. Because outside of Christ, God's moral way of governing is only the thundering of the law to you. So you can only really approach God through Christ, reconciled. Once you've been reconciled to God, then and only then can you acquiesce with a heart acquiescence in what he is doing and why he's doing it. That it's the right, just, holy, and good thing. But that can only come from a heart that has been transformed by faith in Christ. God's law remains the Lord's permanent charge, whether or not it's obeyed by men. Matthew 5, 17 and 18.
Matthew 5, verses 17 and 18. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled.
And it remains so when presented and acceded to in its covenant form. Psalm 78:10.
Psalm 78:10, they kept not the covenant of God and refused to walk in his law.
But when it is accepted in vowing to God, it's so conveyed over to the believer that at once he is called to keep it sacred to the Lord's service and to stand chargeable in his sight for the use he makes of that precious trust. Matthew 25:19 and Luke 19:15.
Matthew 25:19. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them.
Luke 19:15. And it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to be called unto him, to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading.
Yeah. So, what this parable is talking about is, in covenanting, when you yield yourself pliable, remember Calvin's symbol, his personal seal, the heart with in the palm of the hand. It said, "Give me thine heart." And Calvin's response, or Calvin suggested a response to us, is promptly and sincerely. That idea is what we're talking about here. That God gives us the grace and we acquiesce. There's now, in this acquiescence, there is an accession. There's a trust that's been created, and God will call us to an account of that trust. What did we do? Context of this covenant, what did we do with this trust? We are in a position now, better than anyone, to yield an acceptable obedience to God. What did we do? That he may not dishonor the God of his salvation by making little progress in the use of the precious means of spiritual improvement, that he may not be found unfaithful, he endeavors to manifest a deep-felt sense cherished by him of the reality of his obligation acknowledged, as does the psalmist in Psalm 119:111.
Psalm 119:111. Thy testimonies have I taken as an heritage forever, for they are the rejoicing of my heart.
Think about the language of the psalmist. Thy testimonies. He's talking about the law in dynamic relation to the people of God, that is, in covenant relation. He's saying it's the thing that he, in fact, takes supreme pleasure in meditating upon this and finding great delight in this. Because he looks at the law not simply as the obligation of a lawgiver, but as the expression of God's desire for that man that loves him sincerely. All right. So there again, we see in this then that there's got to be an obligation conferred. You can't have all of this without conferring of obligation. Right. Third, these last 2 points are not quite as long as the first two, but I think they're equally important here. Third, the Lord commands that the vow be paid. Look again at Psalm 76:11.
Psalm 76:11. Vow and pay unto the Lord your God, that all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared.
How could God say vow and pay if there's no obligation? That vowing confers an obligation which requires payment. And that's sensible, isn't it? I mean, think of the examples we have in Scripture. A lawful promise to men binds to performance. Why not then a vow to God? Look, for example, at Matthew 5:33.
Matthew 5:33. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but thou shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths.
Yeah. We're not to forswear, we're to perform our oaths. So a lawful promise among men binds to performance. God acknowledges that. Jesus is telling us that, right? Why not then a vow to God? Well, of course, a vow to God. In fact, the vow to man, the promise to man, is binding because it is of it occupies a dependent relation to this higher obligation. The higher obligation is established. We're to vow to God and we're to pay. No? You know, that the same reasons that are controlling that obligation are there for man, between man and man. Even if the persons in question could possibly be of such a superior nature as the true God is to, in comparison to man. If the vow made, whether in the use of the oath implicitly or explicitly, be not paid, the truth will not have been spoken, contrary to the ninth and also the third commandment. So look at Exodus 20:16. And then verse 7.
Exodus 20:16. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Verse 7. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless of taking his name in vain.
Yeah, so what is this? What's going on? Well, the truth is exactly what is being promised when you take an oath. Or you make a vow. The truth is what is in view. If you don't do that, if in fact you don't honor the truth in that, at the end of it all, you've not only broken the ninth commandment about bearing false witness, you've taken the Lord's name in vain. It's hard to do one without doing the other from that direction. And thus, the command enjoining the truth to be spoken and that forbidding that God's name be taken in vain both inculcate, therefore, the fulfillment of the vow. Look at Ecclesiastes 5:4.
Ecclesiastes 5:4. When thou vowest to vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed.
Yeah, so here in Ecclesiastes 5:4, we see the third and ninth commandments being linked together. Because they're intimately connected from that direction. when we talk about this. So even were we altogether ignorant of the reason why the vows were uttered, we should, because of the authority of God, willingly acquiesce in them. Look at Hebrews 11:8.
Hebrews 11:8, by faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went.
Yeah, did Abraham know the end for which he went? No. Did he really know the purpose of the vow he was under? At least at that point, it doesn't sound like it. So, we should acquiesce in this, even if we don't really understand the reason why the vows are uttered. But the grounds of them, God has been pleased to make known. Look at Psalm 98:2.
Psalm 98, verse 2. The Lord hath made known his salvation. His righteousness hath he openly showed in the sight of the heathen.
Yeah, it may be. You might say, well, why is he having us do all of this? It seems like we're jumping through hoops to obey God. What? God, why? I mean, we have to obey him. He's the supreme lawgiver, right? He's our judge. What more incentive do we need? The psalmist says, no, God, you see, God is revealing in all of this his salvation and his righteousness toward men. You wouldn't see any of that if you approach the law only as the commanding of a lawgiver. It's at second glance, when you have come under the influence of the gospel and grace, that you can look back at that and say, ah, that wasn't all to no point or purpose. This all has direct bearing upon the salvation of the elect people of God. This is a problem then. Right? Because, as I've said in different contexts, in different cases, discussing different matters, the non-elect, or the unconverted, or the unregenerate, tend to hear the law in its thundering. So everything sounds like a do, don't, do this, don't do that, do's and don'ts, right? You will do this, you won't do that, wills and won'ts. But God wants us to hear the law not as the thundering on the mountain. Wants us to hear the law as the expression of his eternal love for his people, which is why it gets placed right at the center of his redemptive purpose in Christ. Why did Jesus have to come and die? Getting into the question of whether or not there is a necessity of nature, it's not the case. This is the way God wanted to do it. But the way God wanted to do it is the way which actually highlights and focuses on the law. But he does so in a way that brings redemption to sinners. So we know then that this was made subservient to salvation. Right, a disruption of ends from means, grosser than the separation of the fulfillment of the vow from the making of it, could not be perpetrated. Look at Psalm 50, verse 14.
Psalm 50, verse 14. Offer unto God thanksgiving and pay thy vows unto the Most High.
Yeah, a vow is nothing. Yea, it's worse than nothing, even injurious to those who make it, and dishonoring to God if it be not performed. Ecclesiastes 5, 5.
Ecclesiastes 5, verse 5. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay.
Yeah, it's better because it's injurious, right? If you separate this idea of vowing from the idea of paying, that is, if you separate the idea of covenanting from obligation, then a vow is not just a bad idea, it's worse than nothing. Right, fourth, this is our last point for this personal covenanting section. The Lord threatens those who keep not his covenant, even with temporal and spiritual deprivations. Look at Jeremiah 11, 3, 4, and 10 to 12. Deuteronomy 29, 18 to 21. Jeremiah 34, 18 to 20. And Ezekiel 17, 18 and 19.
Jeremiah 11, 3 and 4. And say thou unto them, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, cursed be the man that obeyeth not the words of this covenant, which I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt from the iron furnace, saying, obey my voice and do them according to all which I command you, so shall ye be my people, and I will be your God. Now verses 10 through 12. And they turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words, and they went after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring evil upon them, which they shall not be able to escape. And they shall cry unto me, and though they shall cry unto me, I will not hearken unto them. Then shall the cities of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem go and cry unto the gods unto whom they offer incense, but they shall not save them at all in the time of their trouble.
Deuteronomy 29, verses 18 through 21. Lest there should be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations, lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. And it come to pass, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of mine heart to add drunkenness to thirst. The Lord will not spare him. But then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy shall smoke against that man, and all the curses that are written in this book shall lie upon him. And the Lord shall blot out his name from under heaven, and the Lord shall separate him unto evil out of all the tribes of Israel, according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in this book of the law.
Jeremiah 34, verses 18 through 20. And I'll give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant, which they had made before me, when they cut the calf in twain, and passed between the parts thereof, the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs and the priests, and all the people of the land, which passed between the parts of the calf. I will even give them into the hand of their enemies, and into the hand of them that seek their life. And their dead bodies shall be meat unto the fowls of the heaven and to the beasts of the earth.
Ezekiel 17, verses 18 and 19. Seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, when, lo, he had given his hand and hath done all these things, he shall not escape. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, as I live, surely mine oath that he hath despised and my covenant that he hath broken, even it will I recompense upon his own head.
Yeah, so in our third point, we had to consider that, you know, vows are made to be paid, and it makes no sense to make a vow that doesn't have an obligation, right? Now, the fourth point, we're saying, look, beyond that, the Lord actually threatens with temporal and spiritual punishment those who do not keep his covenant. Now, again, how could that be if there's not an obligation conferred? How could that be a genuine threatening, right? Eternal ruin awaits the impenitent violator of covenant engagements. Romans 1:31 and 32.
Romans 1 verses 31 and 32. Without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful, who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them.
So, were not the acceptance of the law of God in its covenant form to entail obligation, the breach of it would not be denounced as a breach of covenant. But look at Jeremiah 5, 2 and 9.
Jeremiah 5, verse 2, and though they say the Lord liveth, surely they swear falsely. In verse 9, shall I not visit for these things, saith the Lord, and shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this?
Nor would his wrath descend on men as unsteadfast in his covenant, or as having broken it, but as having violated his holy law. It's
Psalm 78:37. Psalm 78:37. For their heart was not right with him, neither were they steadfast in his covenant.
Yeah, and again, the point here is this. God does not denounce a curse against them or condemn them or talk about his wrath descending upon them simply because they violated his holy law. Because they were unsteadfast in his covenant. That couldn't be unless there was an obligation. Covenanting confers obligation. Where there's guilt, there's sin. Where there's sin, there was obligation. And where there's punishment, there were all. Guilt, sin, and obligation. Genesis 18:25.
Genesis 18, verse 25. That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?
That's a rhetorical question. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Well, of course he shall. But it would not be right by any common conception of right if God should punish where there was no obligation. It couldn't have guilt if there wasn't sin here. This is all pointing to, again, very deep obligation being conferred by this act of covenanting. Right, what was uttered by Jephthah's vow, regarding a vow which was unlawful, must have been employed by the fears of God in reference to vows of which he approved. Look at Judges 11:35.
Judges 11, verse 35, and it came to pass when he saw her that he rent his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back.
Yeah, Jephthah, and this is, I don't want to get into the whole question right here about Jephthah's vow. It was unlawful, but Jephthah's conception immediately was what? I've opened my mouth to the Lord and I cannot go back. Now, if Jephthah says that in the case of a vow which is unlawful, how much more should that be the language and thought of those who are entered into lawful vows? But again, that couldn't be if there was no obligation that was conferred by it. Yet the language of the psalmist, dictated by the spirit of inspiration, confirms the principle that vows and oaths require that they be fulfilled. Psalm 61:8, 116:14, and 119:106.
Psalm 61, verse 8, so will I sing praise unto thy name forever, that I may daily perform my vows.
Psalm 116:14, I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people.
Psalm 119, verse 106, I have sworn and I will perform it, that I will keep thy righteous judgments.
Yeah, so here we have a situation where, again and again, and the psalmist is saying, look, I have a vow. What do I need to do with that vow? I have to perform it. What does he say? I'm under obligation, right? My oath, my vow, that covenant confers obligation. It wasn't necessarily there before in that way, right? Was there an obligation prior to the vow? Yes. It was a legal obligation. It was an externally imposed obligation. But a covenant obligation is an obligation that arises in a person who voluntarily assumes the debt that is owed in that vow, if you will. Or promises. You know, when you promise, you're contracting a debt. So there's a voluntary moral obligation, recognition, which arises from oneself. It's a subjective owning of that obligation. Because it arises from a principle of faith, it actually has the ability to look at the law and appreciate what that represents. Something can't happen when God comes in and says, you know, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. The people hear, I'm in trouble, I'm in trouble, I'm in trouble. But if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. That changes everything. You know, when my people are made willing in the day of my power, that changes everything. You know, when you're ready to do what you ought to do because you want to do it, that changes everything. All right, so that's the beginning of our discussion of the obligation that covenanting confers. We're going to continue next time talking about the obligation that covenanting confers, particularly in the context of social covenanting and the societies which enter into these social covenants. So that's what we're going to continue to discuss next time, Lord willing.